This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. Barbecue is religion in Texas, and every 5 years, Texas Monthly Magazine goes on a quest to find the Holy Grail, the best barbecue in a state that reveres smoked meat. This year, the magazine dispatched 18 writers. They traveled nearly 15,000 miles and visited 341 establishments. In an unheard-of upset, a tiny cafe in central Texas beat out the longtime favorites to snatch first place. Then came the brisket-loving crowds, and as NPR's John Burnett reports, the little barbecue pit that could is strained to the breaking point.
It's about 11:15 on Friday night. We've built a fire in the firebox about an hour ago. At this time, we've got good heat on the pits that we're going to put our brisket on. Get them on and get all the lids closed and leave them alone for a couple hours.
A bandy-legged former rodeo clown and prison guard named Kerry Bexley is the owner of Snow's Barbecue. It's in the little town of Lexington, an hour's drive northeast of Austin. It only opens Saturday mornings. He and three employees arrive by 10 p.m. Friday to light the oak logs.
Heat about 250, 275 in there on them briskets. If I ain't got that, I ain't doing no good.
Barbecue requires heat, smoke, salt and pepper, and thyme. The alchemist of these ingredients is known as the pitmaster. Tootsie Tominetz has been cooking barbecue in Central Texas for 42 of her 73 years. She shows up at 2 a.m. like a Texas tornado.
Y'all just now putting them on fat side down? I don't want them fat side down.
Okay. Well, you want to leave them, flip them back?
Flip them back. I want fat side up all times.
Miss Tootsie, as she's respectfully called, tends the massive iron pits and hissing fireboxes like an admiral minding her fleet. Her gray hair is cut sensibly short. A blue apron is fastened around her waist. During the week, she works as a school custodian. On Saturday mornings, her strong arms turn short ribs and chicken halves, briskets and pork steaks with a practiced flip of the fork. Standing before the pits all night, she's enveloped in smoke. But like a beekeeper resistant to stings, it doesn't seem to bother her. She's all business.
It's 3:30, and we're thinking about getting ready to wrap them in foil. They've got a golden brown.
Time was when Miss Tootsie cooked mainly for locals, but then came the magazine article.
We were named number one in Texas, and that from that point on, our whole business has changed drastically. We have gone from cooking in the vicinity of 300 pounds to cooking in excess of 1,000 pounds. And last week we sold out before 10 o'clock.
Owner Kerry Bexley says people now routinely drive to Snow's from across the state.
There's a gentleman called in this week from Fort Worth, and he ordered a half a pound of brisket, one link of sausage, and two ribs, and is going to drive from Fort Worth for that, and that just blows my mind. $4 a gallon gas, it's just hard to imagine how far people travel for barbecue.
Within Texas, the discovery of Snow's has been met with the excitement that elsewhere might greet the unearthing of an unknown Mayan city or the finding of an unfinished Hemingway manuscript. At Texas Monthly, executive editor Paul Burka is the magazine's final authority on the smoking arts.
My first reaction when I heard about Snow's was, this is impossible. It doesn't happen. There are no unknown great barbecue places in Texas. We've been doing this for years. I've driven all around, and particularly in a town of 1,000 people. It can't happen.
The most famous barbecue places in the state are well known. The perennial pantheon is Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Kreutz's in Smitty's in Lockhart, Cooper's in Llano, and City Market in Luling. And one of them has a century-old pit. So along comes Snow's, 5 years young. But they say the brisket that Tootsie Tominetz smokes is almost indescribable.
I wrote that it was as soft and sweet as cookie dough. That was how I felt about it. It was almost transcended meat.
The price of fame has been high. Snow's was unprepared for the onslaught. The question for anxious barbecue lovers here is whether Miss Tootsie can take the pressure and maintain her quality.
It was a good article. It brought us into the daylight, but it has blown our business out of proportion. There's no time for relaxation. I mean, it's constantly on my toes to catch the next bit before it starts, and here we go.
With the radio keeping them company, the employees have wrapped the briskets in foil to keep them moist. They've made liberal use of Miss Tootsie's mop sauce, made of onions, mustard, butter, vinegar, and Worcestershire sauce. The sun has been up for a half hour now.
It's going on 7. We have mopped the pork ribs again. We've mopped the chickens. Things will be moving pretty quickly now.
With only an hour till opening, the focus of activity shifts indoors to the tiny dining room. Bexley's daughter, Larissa, has driven in from Texas A&M University, and his neighbor, a beautician named Phyllis Rogers, has also come in to serve.
Yeah, we're a pretty laid-back little town, and this is pretty incredible to have these people coming from all over the state and other states just to eat brisket. Of course, Miss Tootsie does a good job. She's had lots of practice. 43 years is a lot of briskets.
By 7:30, there are already 22 people lined up outside, not at all intimidated by the prospect of barbecue for breakfast. Erin Blake and her friends have driven over from Austin.
We heard about it from a friend of ours who said it was the best barbecue in Texas, and we had to come out here and see if it's really true.
At 8 o'clock, Carrie Bexley checks to be sure they have enough potato salad, coleslaw, and white bread, and unlocks the door.
Heard him in.
Good morning. Can we get a pound and a half of the brisket, a 1 pound of the steak pork, and a pound of the ribs and a sausage wrap?
On this morning, Snow's Barbecue will sell out in about an hour. Some frustrated out-of-towners will climb back in their cars and vow to return next week, even earlier. Miss Tootsie will worry that there's not enough barbecue left for her local customers, who she's been serving for decades. So if you're curious about Snow's, do her a favor and forget you ever heard this story. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
1 pound of the pork steak.
One pork steak?
Yes, sir. And a pound of ribs and a sausage wrap.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
During this summer's Olympics, television networks will be broadcasting images of China's national stadium in Beijing. The exterior of this circular structure is a jumble of interwoven beams. Most Chinese have come to call it the bird's nest. The Beijing Olympic Committee calls that stadium an icon of modern China. The bird's nest is not the only modernist building that's gone up in China's capital in the past few years. Internationally acclaimed architects and designers are swarming around the city with big plans and even bigger budgets. Not everyone is fond of the new cityscape, but everyone does take notice. Lisa Chow reports from Beijing.
I'm standing here in Tiananmen Square. Beneath the famous portrait of Mao Zedong, it hangs at the entrance of the magnificent Forbidden City. Most of the buildings in the square are large monumental structures. You've got rigid lines, large columns. They look like dynastic or post-revolutionary communist China. But not far away, there's a striking new building, radically different from what you see here. It's just a few blocks away, so let's walk on over. So here, we've got the National Grand Theater. It's an enormous titanium and glass dome surrounded entirely by water. So to actually get into the building, you've got to go underground. It's probably the most controversial building built in Beijing these past few years, costing more than $300 million. And the architect is Frenchman Paul Andreu.
A modern building in an existing place is disturbing. That is a fact.
After winning the design competition, Andreu met with then Prime Minister Zhu Rongji. He says the Chinese leader knew there was a risk the public would disapprove of the design.
He told me, your building is difficult. This place is gold for us. And take care. But we selected yours, and if we have 51 or 52% of the people pleased, that's a first success.
The government has awarded some of its biggest projects to foreign architects. Besides Andreu's building, the Bird's Nest Stadium was designed by Swiss architects, and a Dutchman designed the new headquarters for China's state television network, CCTV. The government not only spent $1.5 billion on these buildings, it broke rules to make them happen. CCTV's architect, Rem Koolhaas, says China's soaring ambition helped him realize his unusual design.
To reinvent institutions, reinvent laws, reinvent a society, and kind of trying to find the organs that kind of somehow both express but also make it work. That is, of course, unique to this moment here.
Koolhaas's structure includes two L-shaped high-rise towers leaning inward and linked at the top and bottom. It seems to defy gravity. It's been touted as the second largest office building in the world after the Pentagon. Rory McGowan is chief engineer. He's with Arup, a firm based in London.
There is nothing like this anywhere in the world. There is no precedent.
He says because of its shape and size, it broke all the building codes. And so China brought together its top engineers to help come up with new codes. But McGowan says what really set this project apart were the building criteria that CCTV presented to the architects at the start.
The brief was to have the entire workings of the national media company on one site. Okay? That is an unparalleled brief. It's never happened before, and it probably never will happen again.
He says the site will house everything from mobile broadcasting trucks to a hotel, conference facilities, broadcasting studios, and management, where 10,000 people will work. The architect, Koolhaas, points to another factor behind the lofty goal for this building, age. He says in American cultural institutions, decision makers are 70. In Europe, they're 50, 55.
The average age of decision makers here is 30 or 35. And that in itself, you know, is simply statistically means that you're talking to people who are in the beginning of their life and therefore, you know, have the thrust and the sense of adventure.
And yet many young people in Beijing aren't particularly drawn to the flashiness. Liu Qing is 32 and has watched the CCTV towers go up from across the street in her office.
I don't like it. I can't deal with such a modern-looking building. I still prefer more traditional Chinese architecture.
Her colleague, Sun Peng, also 32, agrees.
I think Beijing should construct buildings that reflect the city's history and culture, especially for important landmarks such as the CCTV Tower.
One of the strongest critics is Shao Mo, a retired professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing.
There's a bird's egg in the south, a bird's nest in the north, a bird's tree on the east, and a bird's cage on the west.
Bird's egg refers to the National Grand Theater, tree refers to the CCTV building, and cage refers to the Olympics basketball stadium, designed by Swiss architects.
They've turned our beautiful Beijing into the world's bird capital.
Back outside, Andreu stands in front of his egg-shaped theater, or what he calls a cultural island in the middle of a lake.
I do believe the culture is important. We have all these ancestors and all these ideas behind us, and all these centuries of culture behind us. But what is required from us is to live our life, not to look back.
And at least for now, the Chinese government agrees. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Chow.
And to see photos of the dramatic new buildings in Beijing, visit npr.org.
While Beijing's architecture looks to the future, China's sports system grows out of its past. just as in the days of Chairman Mao, the government pays salaries to athletes. And as we will hear in the coming week on Morning Edition, China spends millions of dollars to train those athletes.
Financially, their life is probably a bit easier than most athletes, at least in the U.S. Most Olympic athletes in the U.S. Are still supporting themselves by college scholarships or other jobs. The result in China is that athletes can concentrate fully on their training.
Sounds cushy, but for Chinese athletes who begin rigorous training early in childhood, the experience can be brutal. NPR's Louisa Lim brings us that story Monday as we begin a week-long series on China's exclusive athletic system.
It's an unusual first, a musical comedy written for and released exclusively on the Internet by a very successful television writer. Hundreds of thousands of viewers watch the first two episodes of Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog online. Tomorrow, they'll get to see the third and final installment. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on this surprise hit.
Dr. Horrible has to practice his evil laugh.
Ah, ha, 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 ha. Ah-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha
and black goggles on his head. Alas, his slightly frightened-looking blue eyes and pale, sun-starved skin make him look more like a baby polar bear, kind of cuddly. Maybe that's why he still hasn't been accepted to the Evil League of Evil.
But my application is strong this year. A letter of condemnation from the deputy mayor. That's got to have some weight, so fingers crossed.
Dr. Horrible was created exclusively for the web by Joss Whedon, who also created Buffy the Vampire Slayer for television. Dr. Horrible has the same kind of quirky cult hit feel, but it bypasses television altogether. And Whedon says the web gave him a new kind of creative freedom.
I'll decide based on what I think we can pull off and how many songs I think we can write and, you know, how much story we have to tell.
It's fun to watch the aspiring evil genius break into a heartsick love song because he just can't seem to talk to a girl he meets regularly at the laundromat.
Laundry day, see you there, under things tumbling.
Dr. Horrible is played by actor Neil Patrick Harris of Doogie Howser and How I Met Your Mother fame. Felicia Day from Buffy the Vampire Slayer plays his love interest, and Nathan Fillion from Desperate Housewives is Dr. Horrible's nemesis, Captain Hammer.
Is she here?
It's curtains for you, Dr. Horrible. Lacey, gently wafting curtains.
All this talent got together in the midst of last year's Hollywood writers' strike specifically to produce something for the web, says Whedon.
Doing that was an effort to send a message to the community that there was another way, that we could create content and ultimately create jobs without the studios.
Whedon won't say exactly how much the production cost, but he says it's in the low six figures. He says they had no idea if Dr. Horrible was going to be a success.
We didn't really have any marketing. We couldn't afford it. Our publicity department was me and my assistant, Natalie.
When the first episode appeared for free on Hulu.com this Tuesday, so many people tried to watch it that the server crashed. Whedon says they were getting about 1,000 hits a minute. When the second episode came out yesterday, it was just as popular.
This is not just fun video. This is what we've all been waiting for.
Paul Saffo is a technology forecaster based in Silicon Valley. He says everyone's been waiting for TV to migrate to the web. He thinks Dr. Horrible is the first truly original web TV.
It's completely new. It's not a copy of what we did on TV, and it's not a copy of the things we've been doing on the web so far. It's a new kind of musical. It's a new kind of video experience. And who would have thunk that Doogie Howser can sing?
Soon I'll control everything.
Hey! Hey!
My wish is your
Typically, web productions don't make much money. No one knows if Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog will break that tradition. On Sunday, it will no longer be possible to get it for free. Fans will have to pay $1.99 to download episodes from iTunes. Whedon is also releasing a DVD with lots of extras, including musical commentary. Laura Seidel, NPR News. Australia. It's a brand new day. Yeah, the sun is high. All the angels sing. Because you're gonna die. Go ahead and laugh. Yeah, I'm a funny guy. Tell everyone goodbye. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Next, we're going to look more closely at an effort to improve the public schools. It's a plan to give teachers performance pay, like salesmen. The better you do, the more you earn. Teachers who get it now include Colorado music teacher Heather Marner. We heard from her yesterday.
I'm definitely earning more money than I was before. I've worked in other states as well. And with that traditional salary schedule, you know, I could predict what I will be making 3 years from now. Now you don't know. I couldn't tell you how much money I'll be making from year to year. It's dependent on what I can do.
That teacher likes the program, though some don't. An important and troubled school district is now moving closer to merit pay. The district is in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, where Michelle Rhee is chancellor.
We currently have a starting salary for new teachers of about $40,000 a year, and we are hoping to put in place a compensation system that would reward the top-performing first-year teachers at about double that, at about $78,000 a year.
So you're thinking about the possibility of almost doubling somebody's pay if they teach well, but how do you determine who's teaching well?
The bottom line is that we have to look at student achievement levels. We have to make sure that the children in the classrooms of those teachers are really progressing as quickly as we would like them to academically.
If this is purely on student achievement levels and I'm a teacher, aren't I going to just kill someone to get the best students in the easiest classes?
Actually, it's sort of the opposite. We look at the growth that is able to be achieved. And then, you know, there will also be differentials in place for teaching in a high poverty school if you're an effective teacher, that sort of thing. So those are the types of things that we're potentially looking at in our contract. And we believe that all of those dynamics together will actually encourage people to teach the students who need great teachers the most.
Don't you end up with a situation, though, where inevitably you're going to have people who are unhappy that the person in the next classroom dealing with the same kids ends up getting a bonus and they don't, for reasons that they may think are unfair?
Well, that's why it's important that we put an incredibly fair process in place so that people understand what the expectations are at the outset, and that, you know, if their students aren't achieving at those same levels in the same school, they have to look at their classroom practices.
And this fair process you envision right now, it's going to be based on test scores. That's the fundamental thing.
It will largely be based on student achievement levels, yes.
Now, let me ask about who you have to bring on board in order to do your full program. What does the teachers' union have to say about the proposed pay for performance?
The union leadership here is great. There's a union president by the name of George Parker. He is one of the most reform-minded union leaders in the country. We know we've had some tough negotiations, but we've come to something that we believe accomplishes all of the goals of making sure that we're prioritizing kids and ensures that all teachers, regardless of what their choices are treated fairly and they're compensated very well.
Wait a minute. Where does this stand? Is it a done deal then with the union, or you still have details to work out?
Oh, that's why I can't talk about the specifics of the contract, because we're still in negotiation, so we can only talk about things in sort of broad terms.
But you're saying the union has accepted the principle and they're just arguing with you over how much the compensation should be and precisely how people get compensated?
We've come to general agreement on the broad tenets of the contract, yes.
Is it possible you could have a situation where every teacher gets really motivated and goes out there and earns the extra double pay, almost double pay, and you can't pay them? You don't have the money.
No, that will not occur.
You've got the money available for this?
We have the money available.
Where's it coming from?
Mostly from private sources. For the first 5 years, we're looking to have significant external funding for the project. And then we've done a financial model that ensures that over a five-year period, we have the ability as a school system to sustain it long term.
Let me ask one other question, which is often raised when people talk about teacher salaries. I've heard it said, look, it's teaching. It's not supposed to be about earning a bunch of money.
Well, I agree. And I think to a certain extent, if you look at teachers now, these folks are heroic people who have certainly not chosen teaching because of the compensation. That said, I believe that we need to begin to change how the profession of teaching is thought about in American society, because there literally is no more important thing than making sure that every single one of our children gets an excellent education.
Michelle Rhee is Chancellor of the Washington, D.C. schools. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Before he was a best-selling author, Joseph Wambaugh was a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department. And that experience helped Wambaugh write about cops as real people. More than three decades later, he's still writing. And in the last of our Crime in the City series, NPR's Mandalit Del Barco explores Wambaugh's Los Angeles.
Joe Wambaugh is treated like a star when he visits the police station in the gritty Hollywood neighborhood he's immortalized. He's even invited to address the baby-faced officers during roll call.
These young people are not going to know who this old fart is.
Oh, they know who you are, sir. Huh?
Sergeant Donovan Lyons assures him of his cult status within the LAPD. Hanging on the walls of the station are framed movie posters of Wambaugh's famous films.
Anybody see the movies? Oh, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
It's a young crew.
Wambaugh jokes a bit, then offers some advice from his book, Hollywood Station.
There's a line in there that the sergeant, who I call the oracle in the book, says that's true. It's that doing good police work is the most fun you will ever have in your lives. I'll leave you with that. Good to meet you. Thanks.
Wambaugh, who's now 71, is the son of a police officer. He joined the LAPD in the early 1960s after a stint in the Marines. For 14 years, Wambaugh worked his way up from patrolman to detective sergeant at LA's Hollenbeck Station. When he wasn't on duty, he wrote two successful novels about the LAPD, The New Centurions and The Blue Knight, which were made into movies.
Freeze, man! Your head's coming off! Cool it! Cool it! Out of my way!
Wambaugh was also still a cop when he wrote and produced The Onion Field, a best-selling book and movie. It's the true-life story of two LAPD officers who were kidnapped and taken to an onion field outside Bakersfield, California, by two suspected robbers. As the film depicts, one of the cops, Ian Campbell, was murdered. Decades later, Wambaugh stands outside the Hollywood Station, which features sidewalk stars like those on Hollywood Boulevard for movie legends. Only these memorialize Ian Campbell and other cops killed while on duty.
I was put on Earth to write The Onion Field. That's how I felt about it. It was such an emotional experience for me. I took a six-month leave of absence from the police department to write that book. I read 40,000 pages of court transcript. I interviewed about 63 people. And wrote the book in 3 months, went back to my detective table at Hollenbeck Station, and stayed a cop for another year.
Wambaugh's celebrity grew, and he was sometimes hounded for autographs from the people he put in handcuffs. He eventually quit his day job to write and to create, among other works, the hit 1970s TV series Police Story. With his realistic portrayals of cops, Wambaugh transformed the formerly clean-cut Joe Friday image of the LAPD.
Before I came along, Dragnet and Adam 12 were good public relations vehicles for the LAPD, but they didn't attempt ever to tell how the job acts on the cop. The cops in those stories were stick figures, right? There were no third dimension to them. We didn't know who they were and what they felt.
Instead, the cops in Joseph Wambaugh's books do have feelings and flaws, which he says almost got him fired by the police chief at the time. But the current chief, William Bratton, warmly embraces him, and Wambaugh's books are now must-reads at the police academy.
I like to think of myself as the younger, sexier homicide detective he referred to in the story.
Hollywood Detective Sergeant Vicki Bynum says it's difficult to get police officers to open up, but she's among the scores of cops Wambaugh has interviewed over the years to collect their stories, which he then fictionalizes.
Joe's thing is to take you out to dinner, and cocktails flow, and the stories start to flow also. And he's found, I think, that women are a lot more conversive than men. The guys, you know, they usually take a few more cocktails.
Wambaugh's Los Angeles is populated not only with complex cops, but also wannabe actors and drug-addicted tweakers. wealthy immigrants, gawking tourists, and colorful street thugs.
All of the bad guys, or bad women, in my stories are ordinary little criminals.
Take, for instance, characters from Wamba's latest books about Hollywood. Costume celebrity lookalikes greet tourists in front of the famed man's Chinese theater, and sometimes they get into scuffles. In one scene, Batman fights with Spider-Man, and Marilyn Monroe has to call 911.
Yeah, no, I mean, it happens all the time in Hollywood.
Hollywood detective Brett Goodkin helped Wamba with his research.
You do get those calls, you know, suspects dressed as Bart Simpson, and you show up, and sure enough, there's a really angry, maybe high, Bart Simpson that wants to fight. The majority of these street performers have criminal histories, you know, and they get into little squabbles among themselves.
Other scenes in Wamba's new books take place at L.A.'s legendary farmers market, where showbiz old-timers hang out every morning. The group includes actor-producer Paul Mazursky, artist Charles Bragg, and assorted comedians.
Here comes my good friend Edward G. Robinson.
Hey, wait, now.
When Wamba visits, they rib him about how he portrayed them in his books.
He's the geezer. I'm a young stud. He's the geezer. Yeah,
no, I'm the codger. Paul Mazursky's the geezer. I'm the codger.
Aren't they something?
You had to put them in the book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, if I hadn't used them, they'd never speak to me again. The only thing they're angry about, they all wanted to be named in the book. With their agent's name, phone number, available dates.
For lunch, Wamba heads to East L.A. for some Mexican food. At the popular restaurant El Tepayac, he meets up with another old pal, Mike Diaz.
Abrazos! Mikey.
Look what I brought.
Inside, they sit with their backs to the wall in case of any trouble, an old cop habit. Then Wamba reminisces with Diaz, a recently retired Hollywood Station sergeant. Some of Diaz's stories will be in Wamba's next book, Hollywood Moon.
He's like our godfather. He's the one that brought us to the screen and let people know what police officers really like. We have problems. We have heartbreaks. We have divorces. You know, we have kids that run away. We have kids that use drugs. We're just like you.
I'm the padrino.
He's our godfather.
Wamba is now working with Sony Pictures to turn his Hollywood trilogy into a TV series. He says he plans to continue writing about the cops in Los Angeles.
Of course, because I'm an LAPD cop, now and forever.
Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
You can read an excerpt from Wamba's latest book, Hollywood Crows, at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, a green powerboat sets a record for making it around the world faster than anybody else, and oil drilling. But first, Heliobacter pylori. H. pylori is an intestinal bacterium that has made a home for itself in the human gut for thousands of years, and it's a common cause for stomach ulcers. Researchers say it's been all but eradicated in the last few decades by better hygiene and antibiotics. But while ulcers are on the decline, another health problem is on the rise, and you know, that's asthma. Well, is there a connection between the two? Could be. There is a new study published this week in the Journal of Infectious Diseases that suggests that H. pylori, the bacteria in our gut, may not be all bad after all. They may, in fact, be protecting kids from childhood asthma. Here to talk about the stomach bug and asthma is Martin Blaser. Dr. Blaser is chair of medicine and professor of microbiology at New York University here in New York City. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
How can a bacterium in the gut protect the respiratory system?
Well, I think your viewers might, your listeners might be interested to know that most of the cells in the human body are bacteria. They're not human cells at all. They're bacterial cells, about 90%.
Is that right?
Yeah, and not just for humans, but for just about all animals. And these bacteria have been living in us as long as we've been humans and beforehand. They're not accidental at all. Mm-hmm. And they're probably playing many different roles in human physiology. And we've been interested in Helicobacter for more than 20 years. And in particular, as you mentioned, we're particularly struck by the fact that Helicobacter pylori, an organism that has been with us at least since humans left Africa, is disappearing. And it's been disappearing very rapidly. As you said, from our most recent work, the work that Dr. Yu Chen and I did, less than 6% of U.S. children have Helicobacter pylori today.
And so at the same time, you're seeing a rise in asthma.
As Helicobacter is declining, yeah. Ulcers are going away, stomach cancer is going away, and diseases of the esophagus, like reflux esophagitis, is rising, and so is asthma.
Huh. Can you create a one-on-one comparison or link between the two?
Well, we have been interested in this trend for a number of years and showed about 10 years ago an inverse relationship between Helicobacter and GERD, or reflux, and some of its consequences. And because some patients with GERD also have asthma, and sometimes when you treat GERD, asthma gets better. Hmm. We thought if Helicobacter could be protecting against GERD, maybe it's protecting against asthma. So Dr. Chen and I began a study, actually, a couple of years ago, where we looked at national data, the NHANES data set, which is a random nationwide survey. We looked at NHANES 3, and which was done in 1988 to 1991, and Dr. Chen found more than 7,000 records of people who had information on Helicobacter status and asthma status. And we found that people who had Helicobacter were less likely to have asthma than people without. But it wasn't just asthma. It was also hay fever, and it was eczema and skin sensitization, all of these allergic manifestations that run together. And we were very excited about this result because we had an earlier result in New York that showed almost the same findings. So more recently, we did the study that was just published this week looking at NHANES 4, now almost 10 years later. And in particular, our first two studies suggested that if Helicobacter had some protective role, it was in childhood onset asthma, the asthma that occurs very early in life, and not in adult asthma. And NHANES 4 was weighted toward more children. And we also found more than 7,000 records of people who we could study. And we found, again, the same inverse association between Helicobacter and childhood asthma, very specifically.
So you're saying you didn't find that association in adults?
We did not find it in adults. In particular, I want to emphasize we're talking about when asthma arises.
Yeah.
There's childhood asthma, which arises very early in life. It's associated with these other allergic conditions. Adult onset asthma can be related to allergy. It can be related to smoking and other factors. Whatever the case, we did not find any relationship with H. pylori.
So you're saying that in doing all this research, it may be the allergy reaction in general different kinds of illnesses that have a relationship with the bacterium.
That's right. In other words, it could be. I mean, there are really two major possibilities.
Yeah.
One is that our studying Helicobacter is just a marker for something else. Something makes Helicobacter go away, and that's also affecting the real protective factor against asthma. It could be antibiotics affecting another bacterium. The other possibility is that H. pylori itself is protecting against asthma, and we don't have any proof, but that's the hypothesis I favor.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that Helicobacter is helping arm the immune system in a way that regulates allergy.
Wow. Can you set up an experiment that would test that hypothesis?
Well, we're trying to test the hypothesis in a number of ways. We may be able to collaborate with colleagues and look at animal models of asthma. There's a model of asthma in rhesus monkeys. We're interested in studying the kinds of regulatory cells and the kinds of regulatory substances in the blood of people who have Helicobacter and who do not have it, so that we can further develop the mechanisms of the association.
Mm-hmm. So did this decline in H. pylori happen when antibiotics, post-World War II antibiotics took over?
As far as we can tell, the decline in Helicobacter began early in the 20th century, but has continued and was probably accelerated after World War II with the invention and widespread use of antibiotics. And in that sense, the U.S. is leading the rest of the world, but the rest of the world seems to be catching up. Mm-hmm. Asthma is quite epidemic in the U.S. and other Western countries.
So if it's not linked to those antibiotics originally, then it's linked to other things like hygiene, things like that?
Hygiene, cleaner water, smaller family size. Most people haven't given much thought to it, but one of the things that we know is that families are a lot smaller than they used to be. And families are very important for transmission of microbes and other infectious agents. And this may be changing kind of human ecology.
You know, there was this research that's been talked about on and off for the last few years, talking about if kids are exposed to playing in the dirt, they get fewer cases of asthma.
So I can't tell you that much, but my general view is that the microbes in dirt are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really adapted for humans. However, the microbes that have been living in humans and our ancestors for millions of years and now are disappearing, I think are much more relevant. I've called this the disappearing microbiota hypothesis. It's a little different than the hygiene hypothesis. And in this case, Helicobacter is kind of the indicator of that phenomenon. Helicobacter is the dominant organism in the stomach. And if an organism disappeared in the colon, the skin, the vagina, we probably wouldn't even be able to detect it.
Let me get a quick question from a listener in. Let's go to Srick in Louisville. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday. Are you there?
Oh, hi. Yes. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I guess, slightly unrelated to the Helicobacter, but... apparently, one of the hypotheses behind the emergence of inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis is that it might have something to do with the disturbance of the equilibrium of bacteria in the gut. And I was wondering if your guest had some comments about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things is that apparently it's also very highly prevalent in the West and not so much in Asian countries. And
Let me get an answer.
Well, you know, you really said the key word, which is equilibrium. That's really how we are viewing this, that we live in some kind of equilibrium with our microbes. And our hypothesis, at least with relation to the stomach and asthma, is that that equilibrium has been disturbed. As I said before, that equilibrium could be disturbed in many places of the body, except that we don't have the candidates right now. We don't know exactly which microbe it could be.
That's fascinating. You say that there are more microbes, more germs living in our body than cells.
Yeah, 90% of your body is microbes.
And we don't understand then.
We understand very little, and that's one of the reasons that the National Institute of Health has made the human microbiome one of their big research projects over the next 4 years, to really understand what are the normal microbes of the human body and how they affect human health and disease.
So when we treat disease, and we don't know anything about most of the germs that are living in us.
Well, exactly. You know, 20 years ago, if I told you that every time you turn the ignition on your car, the polar ice cap is going to melt a little, you would have laughed. And if I tell you today that every time you take an antibiotic, you're chipping away at your microbiome and the microbiome that you transmit to other people, and that all these 50 or 60 years of antibiotics are actually changing our microbial composition, that's about as far-fetched as that other thing was.
Yet we do, and we must learn to understand that if we're going to be treating illnesses.
Right. Our hypothesis is that every time somebody takes an antibiotic for a throat infection or an ear infection, it's having an effect on the microbiota. Again, using Helicobacter as the indicator, there's evidence that this is correct.
But you're saying also it started before we even took antibiotics.
It did, because it had to do with the transmission of the microbes from person to person, and that's where issues like crowding, cleanliness of the water, and issues like family size. You know, another thing that could affect it is that more babies are born today from cesarean sections rather than going through birth the traditional way. More babies are fed with formula than being breastfed. All of these things affect the microbes that are being transmitted, let's say, from mothers to their children.
Fascinating, Dr. Blaser. Fascinating. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Yeah, my great pleasure.
And good luck to your research.
Thank you so much.
He's Dr. Martin Blaser, professor of microbiology and chair of medicine at New York University. We're going to take a break, switch gears, and come back and talk to the captain of a racing boat, a boat that set a world's record of time, speed for going around the world. And it's not made out of your uncle's. This is not your uncle's car. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flato. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.